Jeff Bezos sold the most of the executives, 3% of his Amazon shares worth $3.4 billion. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by an amazing team, most of whom who are working from home to protect themselves and the community. Democracy Now! Is an amazing team of committed producers and staff. Thanks so much to Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Jarena Nadura, Tamari Astudio, Adriano Contreras, Maria Tarasena, Julie Crosby, Dennis Moynihan, Miriam Barnard, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira. Special thanks to Becca Staley. Juan Gonzalez joining us from New Brunswick. I'm Amy Goodman in New York.
Radio's greatest application is in broadcasting mass entertainment. Probably one of the best ways to get started is to make it a hobby and build an amateur station. It will show you more quickly than anything else whether or not you can succeed in radio.
KBOO, Portland.
At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to newsdirector, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the state of emergency has been extended in the city of Portland. The U.S. government has approved a $2 trillion rescue stimulus package, and in international news, coronavirus continues to spread as countries take various precautions. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 25th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. Mayor Ted Wheeler has extended the state of emergency in the city of Portland for an additional 2 weeks. The original declaration, enacted on March 12th and set to expire tomorrow, March 26th, states that the duration of the declaration will be limited to 2 weeks and may be extended in two-week increments as the pandemic continues. This follows the, quote, stay home, save lives order from Governor Kate Brown on Monday. Mayor Ted Wheeler said on Wednesday, quote, we're still on the upside of the contagion curve, so now is not the time to suspend an emergency declaration. We collectively decide how deep and how long this crisis lasts. We'll get through this together. Stay home, stay healthy in the meantime. Oregon has 209 known cases of the virus, though the actual number of cases is likely higher, and there have been 8 reported deaths. The state of emergency will remain in effect through 8 a.m. on Thursday, April 9, 2020. Access to many Portland parks have been closed by the city due to the COVID-19 pandemic. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has more.
In efforts to minimize crowds, several popular Portland destinations have been closed to vehicles, in step with the ongoing novel coronavirus outbreak. The Portland Parks and Recreations Department announced at least 10 parks will be affected by the closures. Roads and entrances to Mount Tabor, Pittock Mansion, Council Crest, Kelly Point, Selwood Riverfront, and Hillside Parks will be closed, gates locked, in efforts to eliminate traffic and thin visitors amid the COVID-19 crisis. Closures will take effect Thursday, continuing until further notice, with more parks likely to be added in the coming days. These closures reflect the latest in state action supporting Governor Kate Brown's executive order Monday, which also closed all playgrounds, outdoor sports courts, and sports fields immediately. Trails and parks around Oregon remain open as long as visitors strictly maintain 6 feet of social distance.
That was KBOO's Jeffrey Wade. Census Day is a week away, and despite the ongoing restrictions due to coronavirus concerns, it is still vital that you submit your reply. With stay-in-place orders affecting Oregonians, officials are urging citizens to respond online. Prompt responses could have a major impact on how much money our state receives as the U.S. government finalizes its $2 trillion emergency rescue package. Multnomah County Commissioner Lori Stegman said in a press release, quote, "The money, depending on the population of Oregon, will come back to the state and is about $4,000 per person that is counted." She also said the money will help fund programs such as WIC, SNAP, school lunch programs, transportation planning, hospitals, and health care. Fill out the census, citizens must go to 2020census.gov and make sure they have the census ID that they received in the mail. The process of replying online takes roughly 5 to 10 minutes and will minimize the need for census takers to risk their health by going door-to-door. Again, that website is 2020census.gov. The Oregon Legislature has formed a joint committee for responding to the COVID-19 pandemic. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg has the story.
The Oregon Legislature in Salem has formed a joint committee for responding to the COVID-19 pandemic in the state. They met today and yesterday to hammer out a bill to provide immediate financial aid and support to those most in need in the state. Here's Senator Gelser talking about priorities for the legislative package that the joint committee is preparing, followed by Representative Holsey, one of the committee chairs, and then Senator Haywood.
I think, like others, the key is medical capacity and access to medical care and equipment and caring for our healthcare workforce, housing. I think the issues the Chief Justice brought to us earlier, including the authority for the Chief Justice to make some declarations or whatever her function is to do right. That is really important just for the general order of the state. And then the regulatory streamlining to the degree that there can be a pause on license renewals, criminal background checks, again, just a pause so that at the end of the emergency, there's, you know, maybe 90 days after that, everything just gets extended by 90 days past that time. And in terms of anything that we do, I just want to reinforce how important it is that it's targeted and that it's time limited. Our financial resources have to be targeted, as we had that debate earlier today. Individuals have significant needs. Businesses have significant needs. And we also have very significant social service needs, domestic violence, child abuse, intellectual disability services that are really struggling right now. So we really have to look at each dollar to see where we get the most bang and we get it to the most need. And anything that we're relaxing that we have all worked so hard and negotiated and put into place really has to be time limited, and we have to understand how exactly the benefit of that outweighs the risk of any of those changes.
These are trying times. People are going to depend on us, and I think that that's where it's at. We need rent relief. I actually liked the utility one for providing direct assistance to, low-income households again. Because I keep coming back to the same thing. If this thing lasts 30 days or 60 days, we need to figure out how to keep people safe and healthy. And unfortunately, that means that they probably need to be staying home and quarantine themselves from this virus. And that's sort of the reality of it, and the state of Oregon didn't cause this virus, and nobody's to really blame for this virus, but it's here and we need to deal with it. So I just really appreciate this group, like Senator Roblin. I'm honored to try to work together with the co-chairs and try to represent the viewpoint of this committee on recommendations. And I know it's challenging because we don't know how much things are going to cost yet, which things will cost money, whether we're getting resources from the federal government that will take care of some of these things, and then we can be flexible and refocus our dollars in a different direction if it ends up getting taken care of. So it's a moving target. That's why it's confusing, and I appreciate this committee trying its best to hone in on what's important, and I know we'll come out with some good results out of this process that will end up helping Oregonians get through this. We won't be able to help everybody as much as they all want, because we just won't have those kinds of resources within our state budget anyway.
Toward the end of the proceeding today in Salem, one of the state legislators raised the point that there has been confusing guidance from the governor's office to law enforcement at the county and city level, leading to some people already having been pulled over today while driving and ticketed for violating the governor's decree that was issued yesterday, including this example of a mother who was pulled over in Linn County while picking up her child.
Just around the issue of intensity and importance, while we were wrapping up, I received a message from a local attorney where a parent was driving their child to parenting exchange. She was pulled over twice and told that parent exchange is not a sufficient reason to be driving. And so she is not able to pick up her child under threat of arrest. So I think that this issue of getting some clear direction around child exchange is incredibly important. And that has all happened in the last 20 minutes.
What happened?
What city is that in?
Linn County. And this client, this attorney's client, was driving to go pick up her child. She was pulled over, explained it was for child exchange. Law enforcement said that was not a sufficient reason to be on the road. She needed to go home or be ticketed. She tried again and got arrested by somebody else, got pulled over by somebody else and told the same thing. So we need clear direction.
That's
about it.
There's something.
Okay, thank you.
Would you clarify city or county? Because
Linn County is what this attorney is. I can just read you the text message. Linn County law enforcement pulling people over and telling them child exchange is not sufficient reason to be driving. Client can't get the child for pickup. I said, for real? She replied, yes. Just happened, pulled over twice. Super timid mom, now scared to keep going. We need clear direction.
Those were excerpts from today's session of the Joint COVID-19 Committee in the Oregon State Legislature. They're expected to issue a legislative package by the end of the week to provide support for medical personnel, small businesses, workers, and families in the state. For KBOO News, this is Jenka Soderberg.
Portland police have reported a spike in calls related to suicide and suicide attempts, a potential indicator of shared public anxiety in the face of COVID-19. We go to KBOO's Jeffrey Wade to hear more.
The number of suicide calls sent to police via 911 dispatchers rose 23% between March 12th and March 22nd, following the city's coronavirus state of emergency. These startling statistics were released on Tuesday by Portland Police Chief Jamie Resch, though Resch also reported the total number of 911 calls had decreased by 10% for the same period. Supervisors from Multnomah County Crisis Line and the nonprofit call center Lines for Life said they did not experience a corresponding rise in suicide-related calls, though they are expecting the volume to increase. Greg Borders, Lines for Life's chief clinical officer, said the majority of calls have been involved in people's fears and anxieties regarding COVID-19, with call takers noting people calling with depression over fears of transmission of the virus, shaky personal finances, and a general upheaval of personal routines. Mental health experts are urging people to reach out and find creative ways to connect with friends, family, and to maintain communications with support services. Amid residents staying indoors and avoiding others, Borders said, quote, "This is a time where it seems the message is to isolate, but I think the message is more important now than ever not to isolate."
That was KBOO's Jeffrey Wade. Service changes are expected for TriMet, though it will continue providing transit service during the coronavirus crisis. TriMet says ridership has fallen nearly 45% and is expected to drop further following Governor Kate Brown's stay-at-home order that was issued on Monday. Service reductions are imminent, with TriMet saying new transit schedules will be announced in the coming days. Public transit is considered an essential service and a critical infrastructure function as outlined by the Department of Homeland Security and the Infrastructure Security Agency. TriMet has advised riders to check schedules at trimet.org/alerts before heading out, as well as updates on trimet.org/health. Regarding the novel coronavirus crisis, riders are urged to stay at home unless absolutely necessary and to maintain 6 feet of distance between other passengers and the operator when using public transit. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with a third-grade teacher and how she's responding to the crisis. And stay tuned after for News from the BOO. At 6, it's The Underground. Then at 7, tune in for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy and chilly with a low of 35 degrees. Tomorrow will be cloudy with a high of 52. Today in history, on this day in 1965, civil rights activists led by Martin Luther King Jr. successfully completed their 4-day, 5-mile march from Selma to the Capitol in Montgomery, Alabama. The march was orchestrated to demonstrate the desire for equal voting rights. The quote of the day is from Martin Luther King Jr. He said, quote, "The time is always right to do what is right." KBOO News poet Dan Raphael says, "Don't worry, get ready."
When you're worried about yourself, family, friends getting sick, when your job shut down and there's no money coming in, who wants to worry about a president who wants to suspend habeas corpus and other constitutional rights, a Senate that wants to give billions to large corporations, and each of us a thousand or so, just once? We know the wealthy will bleed us even drier, price gouging on drugs, officials using classified information to protect and increase their millions. Trump says the economic system, the rich profit while the rest of us go further in debt system, matters most. So forget social distancing and get back to work. Once the virus runs its course, the continuing plague of capitalism will roar back with angry hunger. Our already threadbare, overstressed safety nets will leave many more of us locked down, underfed, vulnerable to what comes next, be it another pandemic, martial law, 4 more years of a president who should never have been elected. We still have the web and phones to start planning for a healthier future. The virus is showing us more clearly who our enemies are, what structures are keeping us down and vulnerable, what we must and can change. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
White House and Senate leaders of both parties announced approval of an unprecedented $2 trillion rescue package that will give direct payments to most Americans. The agreement was reached early Wednesday morning with emergency legislation to aid businesses, workers, and healthcare systems slammed by the coronavirus pandemic. The largest economic rescue in history, this pandemic response hopes to aid the economy from spiraling further into a recession, to help those who are unemployed due to the crisis, and to send money to those on the front lines in hospitals. In addition to direct payments for most citizens, the package will expand unemployment benefits and provide a $367 billion program for small businesses. Though full legislative text of the bill is still being finalized, a one-time stipend of $1,200 to individuals is likely, with $2,400 for couples and $3,000 for a family of four. President Trump's recent claims that malaria drugs can treat coronavirus are not proven by clinical trials, though as a result, there are now shortages of that medicine. Diane Bernard has the story.
Health officials are issuing warnings about the use of anti-malarial drugs after President Donald Trump touted them as a possible cure for COVID-19. His comments have sparked stockpiling around the world. Mass use of chloroquine and other quinine drugs without testing is a public health danger, says Dr. Remington Nevin, a Johns Hopkins epidemiologist. He explains this class of drugs can be neurotoxic with disturbing and possibly permanent mental health side effects.
The widespread use of chloroquine for prophylaxis is associated with a measurable increase in the rate of incidence of neuropsychiatric illness. A population prophylaxed on chloroquine will be more anxious, more depressed, more psychotic, and more suicidal.
He says he's troubled that some doctors in the United States have started to prescribe the drugs for use against the coronavirus, but he points out that their effectiveness has not been demonstrated in full-scale clinical studies. After Trump's comments and follow-up tweets about chloroquine, many hospitals and individuals started stockpiling it, as well as hydroxychloroquine. These anti-malarial drugs are vital for treating the symptoms of lupus, according to Dr. Michelle Petrie with Johns Hopkins Lupus Clinic, who says the run on them is preventing her lupus patients from getting refills from their local pharmacies.
If it turns out it does work for coronavirus, then our government needs to ramp up the production so there will be enough for people who have COVID, but also for the lupus patients who cannot survive without it.
U.S. hospital orders for chloroquine rose 3,000% in the first 3 weeks of March compared with typical demand, according to Premier Inc., which purchases hospital supplies. In the same time period, hydroxychloroquine orders were up 260%. For Public News Service, I'm Diane Bernard.
A reservation stay-at-home order is in place as tribes across the country report their first positive cases of COVID-19. With that story and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Nation is reporting additional cases of COVID-19 while other tribes are reporting first cases in their communities. Navajo Nation leaders were informed Tuesday night the number of positive cases total 49, with cases in Arizona and New Mexico. A reservation-wide stay-at-home order is in place. The Gila River Indian community in Arizona this week reported its first positive cases. One is a Gila River tribal citizen and the other is a member from another federally recognized tribe. Governor Stephen Ro Lewis says they're likely to see more cases in coming days and says the tribe is taking aggressive actions to respond, which includes a task force and command center. The Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma Tuesday announced the tribe's first positive case of COVID-19. Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. in a video message to tribal citizens urges for vigilance.
In one important respect, today is no different than yesterday and no different than tomorrow. A single test result does not mean only one person contracted the virus. The reality is the virus is spreading all over our region. This is a serious health crisis that requires everyone's attention, everyone's cooperation, everyone's dedication so that we can get through this together. Cherokee Nation cannot, and we will not, wait for other jurisdictions to decide how best to protect public health. We will remain guided by facts, medical science, and compassion.
Hoskin says some precautions include shutting down hotels and casinos and conducting much tribal business from home. He also confirmed a Cherokee Nation citizen in Tulsa died last week from COVID-19. Strong Hearts Native Helpline will continue to offer service amid COVID-19. The phone support line 1-8-447-NATIVE supports Native American and Alaska Native people who are experiencing abuse or have family members or friends experiencing abuse. Advocates are concerned about those who may be in unhealthy or abusive relationships as self-isolation and social distancing takes place across the country. Lori Jump is director of Strong Hearts.
All of these new restrictions and not being able to work and, you know, not being able to find just the things that you need at the grocery store is creating additional stress, and that can lead to more violence. So we know that people are experiencing this. And we are encouraging them to, you know, look at safety planning, whether they are stuck at home with their abusive partner, whether they are thinking about leaving, you know, or maybe they've already left. We know that there are increased opportunities for violence happening. And so really to think about that safety planning and how they can keep themselves safe at home.
Jump says during this time, self-care is essential for emotional mental health.
We're strong people. We've weathered a lot of difficult periods of time, right, over in our history and, you know, just our historical traumas that we've all survived. And so I think it's really important to remember that, that we do come from a strong people and we have been through so much and that we can weather this as well.
Strong Hearts is based in Minnesota and will continue to operate the helpline and offer services daily from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Central Time. U.S. Senator Tom Udall announced Wednesday a bipartisan agreement of $8 billion for tribes to ensure direct access to COVID-19 resources for economic recovery and essential services. It's part of a national COVID-19 emergency relief package. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The FDA gave remdesivir, an experimental drug intended to treat COVID-19, what is called an orphan drug status, on Monday. This status provides large financial incentives to the drug's maker, Gilead Sciences, and could keep a lower-priced generic version of the medicine off the market for several years if the drug is approved for use. To qualify for the orphan designation, drug companies must show that their product will treat a population of fewer than 200,000 patients. With more than 52,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 reported in the U.S. alone, and the number of cases continuing to rise, that 200,000 limit will very likely be surpassed. Senator Bernie Sanders said of the matter, quote, "The Trump administration must rescind this corporate giveaway to Gilead and make any treatment and vaccine free for everybody." Remdesivir was developed with the help of at least $79 million in taxpayer funds and is already being studied in clinical trials around the world as a possible treatment for the virus. And now we go to KBOO's Dan Raphael for updates on COVID-19 spread across the globe.
Here's today's global COVID update. 20,499 people have died as a result of the pandemic, according to Johns Hopkins University. The institution says there have been at least 451,000 cases around the world, while 113,000 people have recovered. Recently, the United Kingdom government called for people to help the National Health Service and has had over 405,000 step up and volunteer. Also in the UK, Prince Charles has tested positive for the virus. For the third consecutive day in Italy, the infection rate has slowed. The World Health Organization says the country could reach its peak number of coronavirus cases on Sunday. While Italy has suffered the most pandemic deaths of any country, with 7,503, Spain just passed China to take the second spot. Normally bustling Indian cities like Delhi and Mumbai were quiet on the first day of a three-week nationwide lockdown imposed on India's 1.3 billion people in an attempt to halt the spread of the coronavirus. Hospital admissions in Belgium increased by 50% in one day. Argentina reported its largest one-day increase in COVID cases. And at the epicenter of the pandemic in the U.S., New York City will begin closing streets to traffic, while parks and playgrounds could yet see mandatory closures if New Yorkers continue to ignore calls to self-quarantine.
Some residents believe the government in Brazil's second-largest municipality, Rio de Janeiro, isn't doing enough to protect its citizens from COVID-19, and those residents are stepping up. KBOO's Dan Raphael has more.
In Rio de Janeiro's Cidade de Deus, City of God, favela, it isn't the government that has imposed a curfew, but drug traffickers. The neighborhood, made famous by a popular 2002 film of the same name, was the site of Brazil's first reported case of the coronavirus last week. Red Command gang members with loudspeakers were moving around City of God, telling its 40,000 residents, "We are imposing a curfew because nobody is taking this seriously. Anyone found messing or walking around outside will be punished," unquote. Gangs in several other favelas are also taking actions against the virus, like in Hill of Pleasures, where they imposed a limit of 2 people gathering, as well as a curfew. A street hawker there said, "I'm staying at home, filled with fear and smothered in hand sanitizer." 2 of Rio's 7 million residents live in favelas, where gangs rule and government officials have little influence.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 25th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Jeffrey Wade, Jenka Soderberg, and Suzanne LeGrand. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Voices from the Edge, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective. At 9, it's Press Watch, where host Teresa Mitchell brings you the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and at 11, Between the Covers. Tomorrow, Suzanne LeGrand sits down with Apricot Irving, the author of Gospel of Trees, a memoir, which won the 2019 Oregon Book Award. Then at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures, where you'll find conversations with pioneering animators and comic artists. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you would like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Thanks for listening.
Suzanne LeGrand, and on this episode of We Are All in This Together, I am speaking today with Cindy McGeehan, who is a writer, poet, and teacher.
So Cindy, could you tell us just a little bit about you and what your life was like before all of this pandemic began?
So I am a third grade teacher, and I'm married to an actor and voiceover talent. And so before all of this, my days were very busy, and I would usually get up around 5 o'clock in the morning, had to be at school by 7. The school day is very tightly scheduled, so, you know, an elementary school teacher's day being 5 minutes late is like being an eternity late. We would have lunch around 11, and then when the students left at 2:15, I almost always had meetings, and then, of course, had to do planning and prep for the next day. So on a really good day, I could leave by 4:30, even though my contract ended at 3:15. Often that meant I didn't get home till closer to 5 or 5:30 by the time traffic and all of that went down.
And since then, I know that Portland Public Schools have closed. What is it like for you now?
So I am actually in the North Clackamas School District, and they are also closed because the governor's mandate covered all the schools in the state. So it was kind of a slow roll because before the governor closed schools, the districts were making their own decisions, and our district closed the week before spring break. They made the decision to close that week and through March 30th. And we found out Friday morning and had to have whatever we thought we were going to need, we needed to have it out of the building by 3 that day because we were told we wouldn't be able to go back in the building. And as we now know, that's a longer standing order. So I didn't get to officially say goodbye to my students because the last time I saw them, I didn't know that I wasn't going to see them again until who knows when. I have 30 students, and many of them are impacted by trauma or have been impacted by trauma or are currently living in traumatic situations, at least since my class. So a lot of the conversation has been about, you know, kids having enough food to eat and being able to make sure they're fed, which our district was right on top of. And I know all those schools in the country have really mobilized quickly to make sure that there's meals are available for those kids and their families. There are equity issues around providing online learning, starting with just basic access to digital technology and access to the internet. Some kids have it and some kids don't. Some families have it and some families don't. So it's a pretty significant equity issue to try to require them to continue learning. Because we're a public school, equity matters for us. So we are not allowed to require them to do any kind of assignments, but we can share resources with them.
Have you been able to connect with your students online or by phone? Is it internet?
And then I'll talk a little more about equity because there's kind of another sort of unspoken equity issue at play. But so our district has a lot of learning platforms that have digital elements to them already. A lot of our curricula do. And I've been experimenting with how to use those tools to make some kind of online connection with my students. So I set up a Google Classroom that was just for this strange time we're living in, and I put little slideshows up every week or so. I've put now 4 of them up, so I guess 2 a week is what I've been doing. And they include videos of me, videos of the class guinea pigs, helpful learning links, things that might be fun. I have some links to like some calming strategies. Really, my goal was to try to give them and their families some sort of structure and guidance around stuff they could do. Mm-hmm. So I kind of built it like the shape of our school day, even though it's not required assignments. And they can comment and share comments to me and to the rest of the class in that platform. At this point, 13 of my 30 students have managed to get on there, but that was pretty tricky at first. There was a lot of confusion and a lot of me suddenly wearing a tech support hat that doesn't fit very well, trying to figure out why links weren't working, why they couldn't get on from their, you know, grown-up's laptop or whatever. And then I've also put a bunch of stuff on my school website so that the kids that can't get onto Google Classroom still have that possibility. I sent emails out to the parents, and I tracked which parents I heard back from. And then I have started making phone calls and writing letters. So my goal is to call or write to at least one student a day, just so that whether they have internet access or not, that they hear from me and know I'm thinking of them.
Mm. And you mentioned that there was another very significant equity issue that you wanted to talk about. What was that?
So a lot of kids live with families that and grown-ups that are not able to give them any kind of daily support around this stuff for any number of reasons. Maybe they are still working two or three jobs in that category of essential worker that gets paid next to nothing. A lot of families fall into that. Maybe they are, you know, their own academic background doesn't give them much to draw on. And also there are kids living with adults who are abusive or are neglectful or are dealing with drug and alcohol issues. And so on a good day, when the world is not insane, those kids are already at a deficit. You know, they're the kids that don't get support to do their homework, that don't get any kind of basic support around any of this stuff at home. They're the kids that are the ones functioning like adults at home. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of those kids out there right now. They don't have an adult who's trying to figure out how to make homeschooling happen for them. They don't have an adult who understands that this is a situation that's going to be stressful for them as well, and that they need to have normalcy. They don't have any of that emotional support. And those are the kids I'm the most worried about right now. Because mm-hmm. we can set up, you know, meal pickups, and those kids won't have an adult going to make that happen. Those adults may not even be responding or checking the school communication to find out that there's food to be had for their family. That kid may be the one who normally feeds their younger brothers or sisters, and they don't know that there's an option out there. There's a lot of kids in those situations.
Mm. So I know that we are in a time when there's so much that is uncertain and there's a lot to be afraid of. How is it that you are managing to cope with all this, and also, you know, given what you've said about your students, also dealing with, I mean, that's pretty tough for everybody.
Well, I think I'm trying to take it one moment at a time, not even one day at a time, but one moment at a time. I'm drawing on things that have been sort of my regular tools on a normal day. So I try to start my day with some meditation and some poetry reading and some journaling. I've been doing at-home yoga. I try to get outside for a little bit each day. And try to minimize how much I'm taking in online about this stuff, but that's been incredibly hard because online is also how we're staying connected. So I think I'm just looking for all the little small things that remind me that the earth is still here, human beings are still here, we've survived hard things before. And honestly, a lot of the stuff I've done to try to reach out to my students has been as much for me as it has been for them. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a platform that one of my students suggested called Flipgrid, and only two of them have accessed it so far, but they can make videos and post of themselves, and just seeing their faces saying hello to me was such a blessing. And the couple of kids that I talked to on the phone, getting to hear their voices, you know, taking mm-hmm. a day to write a card to them, that gives me a sense of purpose. And I think that's a good way to keep going. I was thinking about yesterday and today, because we have a few friends who have had people die and they can't do the typical memorial service and stuff, and I've been thinking about the nature of grief in this situation. And at first I was thinking, God, how hard that would be to have the whole world fall apart when you're going through that and you don't have people to hug you and you can't do the usual rituals. And that, I think, is all true. But there's this other part of me that was thinking, when I've had people close to me die, there's that feeling of you're angry that the rest of the world is going along as if nothing happened. And what must it be like to lose somebody and feel like your whole world fell apart and have the world actually stop?
Mm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and now we're all getting to stop and really start to think about that.
I mean, you kind of want the whole world to stop and recognize that your person died, and damn, if the whole world hasn't stopped, you know?
Okay.
I don't know if that's comforting or if that's more terrifying for people, but...
Do you have any hope for something good that might come out of all of this difficult things that we are witnessing?
Yes, and I think just because, you know, you have to be able to find the good, you know, there's going to be an awful lot of hardship that comes out of this, and I feel like any conversation about finding the good has to acknowledge that. But I think that we are all being reminded of how important face-to-face contact is to us as human beings. We're being reminded of the value of being in the sunshine, the value of being outdoors, the value of slowing down and having time. You know, when I was listing off my schedule at the beginning of our conversation, you know, that's one thing that I am appreciating.